The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
This is a program a lot of you have been waiting for, and we're very happy to be able to present it tonight. William Tompkins is back this evening, along with Frank Chile, who made these all possible, and Major George Filer as well. We're going to spend 3 hours tonight again with the amazing Bill Tompkins and talk about some subjects and topics that will really bend your mind, I guarantee it. What do you say about William Tompkins? I would just urge all of you, without going through his biography again, that he lived a life that few men, few women could even dream of living. He has been literally situated at some of the most critical moments of this country's recent history and the last century as well, at the top secret level of the U.S. Navy, and then after the war with the great McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Corporation, Lockheed. Bill has really been there in the middle of so many things. And as far as ETs and extraterrestrials go, you pretty well know already that his experience is extraordinary. He has talked about things like Solar Warden that many people have never heard about before. He also talked about many of the Germans who were running NASA. NASA was a German enterprise. You can call it Nazi if you want, but I call it German. These were Germans. Most Germans were not members of the party. In fact, many of the scientists, of course, were working under penalty of death. If they didn't work, they didn't put out, bad things could happen to them. And so that doesn't excuse the bad parts of World War II, which occurred on both sides of the ledger equally. I think most of you know how I feel about it, so we'll leave it at that. But Bill Tompkins has so much to offer. His first book is out. He's going to be authoring two or three more along with Dr. Bob Wood. And we are being able to, through his kindness and generosity, to share a little bit of some of the future topics and information that he will be offering in the books yet to come. First, let me welcome back Frank Chile. How are you?
It's a wonderful night for revelation.
A wonderful night for revelations. Good. Let's welcome back William Tompkins. Hello, Bill. Thanks for being here again.
My pleasure, sir. I'm perfectly ready.
What's really amazing, the revelations that you have been bringing forward. Frank, are you there or are you down now?
I'm here. You sound perfectly clear.
All right. Now you're not scratchy like you were. Okay. Now, do we have George Filer yet by any chance?
I'm here.
George, how are you?
All the way from New Jersey.
Medford, New Jersey. Just what I was going to mention. Bill Tompkins was involved with top secret U.S. Navy operations based out of Medford, Oregon, which is pretty much where I live. So George lives in the Medford in New Jersey. I live next to the Medford out here, and we've got the country pretty well controlled now. So that's good. But we're going to talk about a lot of things. George, when you get a chance, go on your computer and look in the guests section tonight. Look under your names, yours and Frank's and Bill Tompkins, and look underneath there and you'll see a link. It says Sensational Telescope Photos of Solar Warden Spaceships. And I put a question mark after that because I don't know exactly what these craft are. I do know that they're very big. And I think we should go into this at the beginning of the program and just kind of go through it and get it done. Now, Bill Tompkins won't be able to see these, but he already knows pretty much what we're talking about. Frank can see them. George can see them. You guys both on computer?
Trying to get this to come up. I was talking to people today who served in the military, and they were telling me how off the coast of New Jersey that they see UFOs regularly coming in and out of the water. Just kind of volunteered it to me.
They just said, hey, George, you know, we see these things coming out of the ocean.
Right. They, of course, they know that I'm interested in the subject, but I was rather surprised that they're out there about 100 miles off the coast. And
what are these people doing out about 100 miles off the coast?
Well, some of them are doing fishing, but some are doing their military duties.
Oh, I see. Okay, active service.
Trying to help those who are in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
At various times.
The other thing is, did you tell them that UFOs, at least one, have arisen out of the waters of Lake Filer behind your house and taken off, which you were witness to?
I didn't happen to mention that to them. They were telling me all of their escapades, so to speak, that they had had three major sightings. One, while, I don't know if you remember the ocean stations, particularly here in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
We had ocean stations going out over the Pacific Ocean. And as the planes flew over, you could check, you know, your position with them. Mm-hmm. But in any case, they were saying that during the Vietnam War in the 1970s, they had three UFO sightings out over the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
But in addition to that, over here in the Atlantic Ocean, just recently, they had seen UFOs coming in and out of the water regularly. I said, that's amazing. I just thought it was interesting to bring up long as we're talking about this.
No, that's very good. They call those USOs.
Right.
Unidentified submersible objects. But they're still flying saucers as soon as they leave the water, so they're UFOs.
Right.
Now, have you got the site up? This is very important.
A lot of color, some kind of vehicle with multiple colors.
Oh,
images,
just click on that link.
By John Leonard Walson.
Yeah. Okay, now, very good. Okay, so you, Frank, you're on, right? You got him.
Yep, I'm on it.
Okay, and Bill, we'll get these pictures to you somehow, and you can look at them.
Yeah, I'll need to see
them. Yeah, these are remarkable. Now, let me tell you the story. About, 10, 12, 14 years ago, somewhere around there, John Leonard Walson began contacting me. We had many conversations on the phone. I had him on the program a number of times as a guest. Bill, he was an astronomer at the time, probably still is, in the UK. I'm not remembering exactly where he lived in the UK, but he was an astronomer. He had either an 8 or a 10-inch Meade telescope. And he
That's
did something...
Sport.
Yeah, very good scope. He did something to that telescope that made it have a resolution that was remarkable. And it actually was able to acquire objects in near-Earth orbit that were apparently parked up there. And he would record these. One of his videos was made at night, and it showed him setting his scope up on this favorite hill he would always go to. And his view screen for the telescope was a little 4-inch color monitor. That's not normal with a telescope, but it wasn't optical. He had it switched over to a little digital screen so you could see it. And you're standing back from your perspective, watching all this from the recording he had somebody else make. And the fellow who was making the recording zoomed in on this view screen, hooked up to his telescope, and you could see him acquire and then resolve these objects into the images we see in this picture collection. These aren't by any means all of them, but we could actually see that he was legitimately out at night legitimately finding these things up there and recording them. And then from those recordings, we got these still pictures. Now, the interesting thing about it, I asked John, which I believe is an alias, how he was able to find these ships up in the night sky. That's a lot of sky up there. How did you know where to go to look, to zero in on it? He said, only I just get a feeling of where to look. That's all he would tell me. And, you know, whatever you want to ascribe that to, you can, because he always delivered. He also had a way of using his telescope to image the surface of the moon in such sharp detail that you felt like you were flying right over the surface of the moon. Now, this is an 8-inch, or maybe 10, I think it was an 8-inch scope, and you shouldn't be able to do that. But he refused to describe what he had done to the telescope to make it perform so much better than it normally would. But he did it. So, okay, well, we have, Bill Tompkins, are about 10 images of these things, I'm going to call them spaceships, that are in a parked orbit, or were at the time, stationary, above the Earth. They're not satellites. They're something entirely different. Frank, the first image you see, it's very beautiful with colors. It's got reds, blues, greens, yellows, and variations thereof. There's even a magenta one. And then there's a what
it
appears
looks enormous.
To be... Yeah, it does look enormous. And then it also is a white, round, what appears to be some kind of a light on it. So this was taken at night by John Walson, who suffered any number of indignities. They would fly over his house with helicopters and 50, 60 feet over his head, the UK Army did, or the military did, to try to threaten him. And he would go out with his camera and videotape these helicopters flying right over his head, and they would take photographs of him. This is daytime, and on the bottom of the helicopter would be a flash, and he would actually freeze frame the flash. There was a camera mounted there with a very powerful daylight flash that would illuminate anything below, and they would get pictures of him. So, okay, he was hassled. He also had meetings with some very high-level people about what he was able to find up there in the night skies. I am of the opinion, and we used to talk about this, that they were not happy about what John Walson was finding with his telescope and was recording. So they were hassling him, and he has since vanished. I haven't heard from John in probably close to 10 years. Don't know what he's doing now. I assume he's all right. I have no reason to think otherwise, but... all this tremendous output of videos just stopped. So let's look at these pictures. George, do you have them now in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The first picture, hard to describe. It's a long, we could call it a cylindrical object with some abnormalities in its shape at the bottom end of it, and then what appears to be almost a pointed nose at the top right. It's sitting in the frame at about a 45-degree angle. A very interesting object. Frank, any comments on this first one?
The comment...
You're breaking up again. Hold on, you're breaking up.
The comment I made about it being enormous, Jeff,
yeah,
has to do with the color resolution and how distinct each of those colors are.
Very good.
And they don't seem to merge together. They are distinctively different, and there's probably maybe 18 different colors available lights on this graph.
And they're separated. They're all separated. Basically, they don't
all
run together. They're just, it's a remarkable resolution. I don't know how he was able to do this through the atmosphere, which tends to distort things. No, these aren't satellites. There's something else entirely. Picture number two is a rather monocolor object. It's basically silver in the night sky. Again, clearly built with components, structure, very un-aerodynamic looking, very odd looking.
A lot of detail.
Shape.
A lot of detail on this one, Jeff.
Yeah, yeah. George Filer, what do you think?
Well, interestingly enough, the gentleman that was in my house yesterday who worked for the Coast Guard for many years. His boss was an astronaut. And the astronaut told him that what would happen is they would be up, you know, circling the Earth in a shuttle, and they would get a call from the ground, and they'd say, go to window 6, and you'll see an object coming over, you know, in about a minute. Get ready with your camera to take a picture. So he would go down to the window with his Hasselblad camera and get ready to take a picture as this object came over from the opposite direction. It was going so fast that he was unable to get a picture, even though he took, you know, multiple shots, mm-hmm. just hoping that he would catch it. In other words, our shuttle was moving around 15,000 miles an hour. This object was going the opposite direction so fast that he could not pick it up and take a picture of it. He estimated it was going some 100,000 miles an hour or more. And the point is that the astronauts and a lot of people are seeing them, and they're starting to release the information. And this is probably something like if you do get a picture of what it would look like, some kind of an object that is moving at high speed and is a little bit difficult to discern.
Yeah.
But there's something there that the camera is picking up, obviously.
Yeah. Let's look at the next one. Now, the next one is as refined an image as I ever saw John produce. I'm making a video of these objects. I've got his permission. And we'll be enlarging and enhancing these. But this next one, Frank Chile, is loaded with detail.
Oh, my gosh. Bill's going to go crazy with this photograph. My God.
Well, I think it's obvious we're being visited.
Yeah. What's that, Bill?
Jeff, did he tell you what height they were above the Earth in orbit?
He didn't want to disclose that. It wasn't low Earth. They were out there a ways. That's what he would tell me. Mm-hmm. Could have been 5,000 miles. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. Now, number four, and what we'll do is just kind of go through these real quick because our special guest, Bill Tompkins, has much to say. But just scroll down, look through these images. Remember, there are many more of these. They are copyright. So we ask you to respect that. You can look at some of these. They're just stunning. The last one, absolutely extraordinary geometry on this thing.
Yep.
It was a long, like a tubular end on it with something on the end of that. On the end of that could well be the command and control center. The back part of it might be some kind of a hyperdrive. I don't know. But it looks like that. Again, these are not aerodynamic. So the front of it appears to have, it's roundish. We've got that enlarged. It appears to have square windows in it, viewport. So it does appear that the command and control center is up to the right on this last picture. So take a look at these. And there was.
Jeff, did you ever have more than one object in a photo?
Yeah. Yes.
You did.
Okay. Yeah. The picture before that is ghostly. Look at the tubes and pipes on that. Now, those pipes or tubes could easily be 10 feet in diameter for people to walk through.
Or more.
20 feet. We don't know because I couldn't get the distance. He was very protective of his proprietary technique, and I honored that. So always had a great relationship with him. These pictures are just extraordinary. The more you look at them, the more you realize, A, there's no way they're satellites. B, whoever built them is pretty damned advanced, and these are spaceships. There's just no question about it, none. So,
yeah, no question.
Enjoy those, and let's get right to Bill Tompkins now. Thanks for your patience, Bill. You will get to see these pictures, and you will be amazed when you see them.
I'm looking forward to them, but from your descriptions, I've been making sketches. So I'm going to see how close my sketches are to the photos when you get them.
Yeah, a lot of them have what appear to be tubes connecting various parts to it, covered with they're highly structured and very large, and there's nothing aerodynamic about them. You might argue for the last picture that with the front control in a round module, and then the long neck behind it, a straight tube back to a very large mass, which is clearly suggestive of some kind of a drive mechanism, a very sophisticated one. Now, this just brings another question up. If these aren't ours, who are they? And the answer would be one of our visiting groups of ETs, and they're parked out there. These are what you might call motherships, although they don't look anything like triangles or circular craft or boomerang-shaped craft. They're spaceships, and they look like something from Hollywood movies in a way. Very interesting. Any final comment, Frank, and then we're going to go to George and then get Bill going here.
They don't look like they're intelligently designed. They don't look random at all.
No chance. No chance. George?
None.
Well, there's something out there. I mean, I used to pick them up on radar, and London Control would ask us to intercept, and we would intercept it and be an object that was at least based on our radar a mile long or so. And sometimes they come into our atmosphere. Most of the time, they stay above at least 50,000 feet. I don't know if you're aware of it, but we don't normally go above 50,000 feet because that's where we're asked to stay. Below and above 50,000 is where they go.
That's their territory. Interesting. So no collisions, no problem. Huh. All right, so these pictures...
Hillary says she's going to tell us about...
Oh, Hillary's full of crap. She's not going to do anything. They're never going to let this stuff out of the bag. She's lying. She's catering to people who have hopes and dreams. It's a fraud. Her husband tried. Jimmy Carter tried. Nixon knew. Yeah, they told him at least some of it. But this, it's all... Don't even... I didn't even want you to repeat that because it's such an obvious effort to pander to people. It makes me sick.
They would tell her to take a hike
rather than give her any information that they don't want out.
Well, that's a good chance.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think she used to visit Lawrence Rockefeller, and she knew a lot from him in some of my contacts.
Well, her John Podesta, her chief of staff, is well into the UFO community, as we know, and... Bill Clinton sent Webb Hubble off to find out. He said, go find out what the hell is going on here. Hubble came back and said, they won't tell me. They wouldn't tell the President of the United States or his chief of staff. So, all right. Now,
he had no need to know.
No need to know. That's right.
There's people who are asking that the information come about, and this is why we have Bill here to tell us some of the interesting details.
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath asking the controllers to give us anything. They don't want to. They're not going to. It's just we're just on the outside. But we don't need them. We don't need them. We have enough information to have established beyond any doubt that there is interaction going on between this species and any number of other species who are visiting this planet. All right. With that said, let's turn Frank and George down and go right to Bill Tompkins. And Bill, where do we start tonight? We've got some very eclectic things to talk about, like amazing things. So you want to start with back in World War II with the Germans? How do you want to start?
I guess we could, but I'd sort of like to... get into this situation for the TRW program, where we had like unlimited funds to study anything. And TRW was this massive campus, One Space Park, Redondo Beach, California.
Uh-huh.
And it was about 12 blocks from the beach where all the girls were in their bikinis.
You would notice that, Bill. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. First things first. But the fact that the campus was one thing, and then there were several hundred off-site laboratories.
Uh-huh.
And these actually contain most of the extraterrestrial side of TRW. And I think, like we've said before, Northrop Grumman bought a lot of money, and they bought TRW. So they get all this fantastic stuff that's going on and has been going on to assist them in their endeavors to go out of space. And then, secondly, Northrop buys or borrows a bunch of more money, and they buy the Newport News Shipbuilding Company in Virginia, the people that build the Navy aircraft carriers. And so then they take all of the Northrop engineers and let them climb all over three aircraft carriers under construction. And they use this information to do their design, detailed design, of their kilometer and 4 kilometer long spacecraft carriers for Solar Warden space battle groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just addressing that in sort of a way to get into this subject, it's well established that they did build 8 separate space battle groups by 1982.
8 battle groups. And what would a battle group be composed of?
It's very similar to a surface Navy
carrier group.
You have one, sometimes two carriers. You have like 4 cruisers, and you have maybe 4 or 6 destroyers, backup support ships, and then a couple of submarines way ahead of the battle group. So you have the sort of the same type of surface cruisers, for instance, for the space cruisers,
uh-huh,
and then space destroyers. And incidentally enough, standard U.S. Navy attack submarines, which there's some 12, 14 U.S. Navy standard attack submarines that have the nuclear propulsion removed and electromagnetic anti-gravitational propulsion installed.
That's fascinating. They had the same same construction, right?
Yeah, and so it was the quickest way to get out there, okay? So we actually had the submarines go out before the spacecraft carriers went out.
So they would simply take the front dive and attitude wings off, streamline them a little bit, replace the power plant. They'd have the same dual hull construction, advanced construction, and they just fly them up into space. That's very interesting.
And I think that the fact that if you stop and consider this, it's already a pressurized structure.
Of course.
It's got everything set up, so why not change the propulsion and use it as an operating submarine out in the galaxy?
It's a perfect transition idea. Yeah, of course.
Real cool. And so Solar Warden itself is very ancient today. And there are 6 more, far more advanced, 4-kilometer-long spacecraft carriers, which are under construction now.
4 kilometers long. Why so big? Bill? Why? These are massive. What's the need?
Okay. A lot of people question this. They even question an aircraft carrier against what you can do with a submarine. They combined what would have been a landing assault aircraft carrier. Now, this is an aircraft carrier that doesn't look like a nuclear carrier, and it's not nuclear built. But it is like 800 feet long. It sets higher, has more decks, and sets higher above the water line than a regular carrier. It doesn't have the angled flight deck, but it has either helicopters or VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. And this is a Marine ship. Of course, it's Navy, operated by the Navy, but a landing assault aircraft carrier has a tremendous size inside hangar, which then what they do when they get to the area that they are going to have the battle, they go towards the coast. They flood the rear end of the aft end of the ship. Water comes in, and they have all these landing assault boats with personnel and tanks in the boats.
Right.
The doors open the back, and they just float right out, and they go back to shore and drop off the personnel and the tanks and go back and get some more.
Right.
So a landing assault spaceship then is designed into what would have been just a space craft carrier.
So all right, now, but Bill, excuse me, wouldn't that require a complete, they might as well build it from scratch. They've got to double hull everything. They've got to make it habitable for crew. They have to have airlocks. They have to have all kinds of technology. I mean, they can't just take a landing assault carrier, put a new power plant, and fly it up into space. They wouldn't have, they're not airtight.
No, you're absolutely correct, and we're not saying that. What we're saying is that the class of surface ship Navy assault carriers design is then used in the larger spacecraft carrier, which binds that mission. So you actually don't take a landing assault and then redesign it for space.
Right.
You start from scratch and design a new spacecraft.
So it's a member of the strategic tactical fleet, so to speak, that they're using in space. It's one of the primary capital ships, spaceships in space.
And sort of an easy way to address this. For instance, if we have the Nordic Navy spacecraft carrier groups, they might have 20 of the complete battle groups, okay? But the problem here is that, and the numbers are not for certain, but the problems are in percent pretty close. The Draco reptilian type space battle groups, instead of being 20, are 200. In other words, the Nordics would have 20 of them, the Dracos would have 200. So this is a disadvantage for the Nordic Navy.
Now, are we to assume, Bill, pardon me again, are we to assume that this much firepower is or was lurking around this planet in orbit, or did it come down to the ground level at any time? That's a lot of stuff.
Okay. They definitely do not come back down into the ground in most cases. Yes, they have very large cruiser-type space ships, which can come in the atmosphere, and they are streamlined in shape. But it's in space, and as long as it's operating in space, it can be a triangle shape.
or a square, or a circle, or look like an automobile wreck. It can look any way it wants.
Yeah. It can have all kinds of garbage hanging out the side of it.
Right. Well, wait till you see these pictures tonight. Some of them are suggestive of that. So they're just extraordinary. I'll look forward to getting your response, too, on that. Okay. So we have reptilians with 200 battle groups. We have the Nordics with 20 battle groups. Are these two opposing intelligent life forms at war, or are they giving each other some kind of mutual standoff status? What was the situation between them?
Okay. At one time, we understand that the Nordics did take out, years ago, a group of Draco-type navies and remove them from that area that the Nordic stars and planets are in. However, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So there are both skirmishes and wars existing now, if the information that we have is correct.
All right. Now, when you say 200, when you say, one more thing, please. When you say 200 battle groups, we're talking about spread out all over the, certainly the galaxy, right? They're not here.
Yes, you're not talking about those ships even parked, out in,
I got you. I just want to be sure people understand this is the big picture we're talking about. All right.
Very big. But unfortunately, this is what we have to deal with. And so, it's also understood that the Draco reptilian group have owned this planet for thousands of years. Now, they let and they allow other civilizations to come into the planet and operate their own agenda requirements. So you may have as many as 50 other extraterrestrial civilization people who are here implementing their programs.
I see.
So what this then appears to be is that this planet Earth is simply a large laboratory and being used by many, many different people for all kinds of different agendas.
Right.
And the Draco reptilian groups sort of own this part of the Milky Way arm.
Right.
And so we're in a position where, yes, they got the control, and at times the Nordic people with the white hats are able to get in here along with other extraterrestrials and help us. And that's what's taking place now.
And just to recap, the reptilians were the group, the Draco reptilians, that made the agreement with the Germans in the 30s to help them with technology in exchange for being left alone for their own devices, I assume. But they're the ones that allied with the Germans. They're the dominant visiting ET life form on this planet, correct?
Wearing the black hat.
Or in this, in this end of the Milky Way, right?
Yes, this arm of it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So this then becomes a real problem because the water is the mother's really flying everywhere, and the program to separate ourselves from the control that these people had, the Dracos, who made the agreement with Hitler and with the Third Reich to give them all of this equipment, like 17 different types and classes of spacecraft equipment, battle group equipment, and then put that into production. And so the mission, again, of Hitler and the Third Reich was to enslave most of the people on this planet and put them to work building thousands of there's 17 different classes of spacecraft, military, naval ships, and then support the training for the personnel for this, and then have the extraterrestrials attempt to work together with the Nordic Navy, German Navy, with their own battle group spacecraft ships, operate with the Dracos out in the galaxy and take over other stars, planets, and enslave those people. And that type of an understanding of the mission sort of puts a different light on what Germany was actually doing.
One question. One wonders, if all that is true, why would the Dracos allow Germany to lose the war?
Okay, that's another of the $64 questions. The approach that was used got sort of mixed up, and more of the support that the Germans were getting in World War II from the Dracos were moved to another area almost parallel to what the Nordic navies had, where they were at war not just with the Dracos, but with other civilizations out there, and then had to go back and support their own areas. And so whether that's the actual reason, I guess I have to say I can't answer it. But what took place was, with Paperclip, and with the fact that a good 70% of everything in Germany, in the underground production plants building these spacecraft ships, was moved to Antarctica. And even the slave laborers were down there too, so they could continue this program.
Well, you mentioned that the Germans were given one of three cities, so-called cities down there, large developments, large-scale developments, that wasn't being used by the reptilians. That's where the Germans set up their primary manufacturing down there.
Yes, and I know there's been some discussions on who did what, and it's come out that a different civilization may have implemented some of the things that were taking place in Antarctica before the Germans went there. And but it was definitely the Draco reptilian group that made the agreement with Hitler and the Third Reich to remove everything, as even the backup plan took place way before they lost the war. To move everything to Antarctica, continue production there, and operate from there out in the galaxy.
So maybe the war was kind of just written off as not particularly important, given the size of the project that was going on in the Antarctic. It just dwarfed the war, and they got most of the German upper class out of Germany, as we know, moved them to Argentina. We flew them, the American Air Force flew them, in DC-4 long-range aircraft. We took them down in ships as well. We flew probably tens of thousands of Germans from Germany to Argentina. And the rest of the scientists, of course, that were involved with Paperclip made their way over here in the years after the war. This is all very interesting.
Yeah, and actually you're finishing the second half of the statement, because you get Paperclip, because all these people come over, and some of the first efforts being developed were to develop a vehicle like the Apollo vehicle. So essentially, those same Germans that actually were 80% of NASA were able to accomplish some of the previously missions that were designed way back in Germany before.
Mm-hmm.
And and you have to address that there is literally hundreds of missions. It isn't one mission, but there's a hundred, just like any war. You have 100 different ways to implement the war. And so we're dealing with a situation today where it's necessary for us to address the best we possibly can with the Nordics to let them get through the screens, come aboard, and help us implement our plan to leave this planet and or get the reptilians off.
All right. Okay. Go ahead.
I just want to say one thing on this part of it. You have to ask yourself, why in the secret think tank at Douglas, now this is in my book, why did I and some other people design 17 kilometer long space transports to transport people off of the planet? Who initiated that? Who came up with the requirement? Yes, I did much of the design, but I'm having to say, who said do it? Somebody like the Germans had their program to have thousands of large transports and leave the planet, which was already in trouble, not just from other countries, but from the standpoint that this planet Earth has a lot of geological problems. And like I mentioned before, my cousin John Walter Hamden, a geoastrophysicist, was one of the people in this country who did the large hole drilling program in the Atlantic Ocean and came up with all these programs to implement simply leaving the planet because of the planet's historical history of not just one Noah event where the planet gets flooded and some of the continents disappear, others raise up out of the ocean that weren't there before. And then you have the other situation where you have thousands of volcanoes going from Alaska to Antarctica all at the same time down the west coast of the United States and South America. Right. All these other things that we now know geologically, the planet is not as good as it should be. And we've started to find out that there are other planets out there who can be not only larger, in a better position from the star, and not be subjected to the problems that the sun can present to the planet. And I think that this is another whole area that needs to be addressed.
All right, very good. We have to pause now, Bill, on that note, if you could hold on, please, and we'll take a break and come right back. This is all very interesting. This goes back into the 1930s with the reptilians and the Germans. The Nordics were here involved. And one quick question, Bill. Was all of this common knowledge with Admiral Rico Botta? Was he up to speed on all this, or did this come to you later on?
No, he was definitely. And remember, his mission was from Secretary of the Navy Forrestal. And That's who he worked for.
Uh-huh.
He didn't work for naval intelligence. He didn't work for any other intelligence agency. He was completely independent. And yes, he knew all of it. And yes, he did not believe a substantial part of it until other information came in.
That's
so
remarkable.
We documented the information, and we did implement it.
All right. Okay, thank you. Hold on, Bill. We'll come right back with our two of our conversation tonight, which has many potential directions to go. As you can tell, Bill is a never-ending fountain of knowledge, just extraordinary. Be right back. Hold on.